Welcome to Life List, a birding podcast.
Hello, hello. Welcome, everybody. We are Life List, a birding podcast. I am George Armistead, and I am here with my co-hosts, Molly Brown and Alvaro Jaramillo. Guys, what's cooking?
Hello.
Hey. Another good day for podcasting.
I'll say.
Always a good day for podcasting, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
If we can make it all together, we're good.
Yeah, except for last week. Last week had a little bit of a stomach bug, so it would have been a tough one. In fact, that's kind of why we're here now.
That's right.
Yeah. But yeah, no, it's like to talk to you guys again. I feel like there's a lot going on. Fall migration is happening. Mm-hmm. Molly, I'm sure I know you're back from a trip. Al, you've been kicking some tail offshore there, and then onshore, Southern California, been getting its tail kicked a little bit. So,
yeah, a lot of pelagic birds on the ocean and pelagic birds off the ocean, depending on where you are.
So yeah, it's like
interesting stuff going on.
Yeah,
we should devote a whole episode to that.
Absolutely.
One point.
Yep. In the meantime, we have a special guest here today, Glenn Bartley, well-known photographer, arguably, I would say, well, a personal favorite of mine. I always hesitate to say the best photographer around, but I've been admiring Glenn's stuff for a long, long time. Glenn is in Victoria in British Columbia. Started getting into birds in Ontario, Canada, which Alvaro can understand and relate to. He started out by trying to photograph hummingbirds using a 35mm camera. He now travels all over the world and is going to talk to us about photography and a whole bunch of other photography-related stuff. Glenn has a master's of science in ecological restoration. Glenn, how are you doing today?
Doing great, guys. Stoked to be here with you and talk about all things bird photography.
Yeah, really glad to have you. We've been talking about this for a while. Between your travel schedule, our schedule's been tough to line up because we're all kind of busy moving around. But this has been a long anticipated one. Really, really glad to have you here.
Yeah, and always good to have more Canadian content, you know?
Absolutely.
Canadian. Yeah, more Canadian content. That's I've heard from everybody. We need more Canadians on this podcast. That's
there you
what
go.
I heard from all sorts of people.
Give the people what they want.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, what have you been up to lately, Glenn?
Well, it's actually a little bit my slow season. I tend to schedule a bit of a sort of summer break from tours. But with that said, I was just down in Brazil, in July for a tour that I was leading down there, which was really fun. I hadn't been to Brazil since 2018. I had a trip planned for 2020, but we all know what happened there, and just took a few years to kind of reboot this trip and get things going again. And, it was awesome. That trip, we go to the Atlantic rainforest and to the Pantanal. So two fantastic ecosystems with some really iconic, amazing birds. I don't know if you guys have any of you guys been down. George, I'm sure you've been there.
I've actually not been scheduled to go in August of next year for the first time.
Nice.
I'm excited about that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a great area to visit. Those of us who have traveled on the sort of the other half of South America, you know, you start to get some of the similar birds, fantastic birds, but you start to see, you know, same sort of tanagers and the common hummingbirds and things, but you jump over to the other side. And all of a sudden, basically everything is new. Even things like the palm tanagers look completely different over there. And, you know, so many good Atlantic rainforest endemics and specialties. And then the Pantanal is such an amazing ecosystem with some notable kind of bonus mammal observations. Obviously, very famous as the best place in the world to see jaguars, of which we saw at least five.
Oh, man. So
really, really, really great trip. And now I'm kind of chilling at home, doing a little bit of woodworking and other kind of fun things around the house and getting ready for a very busy fall schedule. So I'm sort of enjoying the calm before the storm.
Gotcha. Nice. Hey,
Glenn, when you go on a photo tour, how many people are sort of, what's the sizing, you know, because we have that whole issue with birding. You know, if you go to Patagonia, you could take a larger group of people. If you're in rainforest, you know, maybe you're 8, 10 max, or 12, 14 max in other places. How does it work with photo trips?
Yeah, that's a good question, and definitely needs to be smaller group numbers. So I, you know, I have quite a variety of trips. From my local tours that I lead here on Vancouver Island, I actually keep those to 4 people. Because I'm, you know, I can come home every day and sleep in my own bed, and I'd rather do 2 or 3 weeks of those trips and have them be small groups that I can really guarantee, you know, to have great opportunities. Usually my tropical ones are 6 people. But some of them, if I have a co-leader and if the itinerary suits it where I can split the group, which I love to do, and sort of, sometimes those ones all go up to 8. 8 would be the max on any trip. And that would only be if I had a co-leader. So sometimes we'll split the group and sort of maybe leave 4 people to shoot around some feeders for an hour or two while I take the other 4 for a big birding walk. And we go do some field photography and try to find some birds that we would never find around the feeders, and then come back and switch and take team two and go for a walk. So, you know, the key is to keep the group to the point where everybody's getting great opportunities. That's, at the end of the day, that's what we're trying to do.
Ken, I guess, like, you know, for us, we often have, you have the checklist of birds, and then there are like 4 or 5 that are the key rare ones for that area. And, you know, people are like, oh, are we going to see the gold ring tanager, whatever it might be? And that's like the, you know, sort of, we have these things that we're going for. When you're on a photo tour, are you, the checklist doesn't matter as much, but it's about the image? Or are there people who are like, oh, I want even a poor image of something rare? Or how does that work? It's kind of interesting for me to think about from a birder guide perspective.
Yeah, it's definitely, it's almost like 2 different sports, you know, bird photography and birding. They're similar. We're both groups are out in nature, but certainly when I see the birding groups at a lodge and they're, you know, every night doing their list and they're really after, you know, seeing numbers of the list is kind of, for a lot of people, the listers, that's the most important thing. They want to go on a trip and see a big number of birds. I would say the bird photographers, it's really not, the number is kind of irrelevant. And people would be satisfied with a way smaller list. The quality of opportunities is what people are going for. And of course, you know, the showier species tend to be real crowd pleasers. So
yeah.
I find that most of the clients that come on my trips are not super, super, super experienced birders. They probably don't know that many of the birds that are in the places that we're going. But they're excited to see and experience the country and to see as many beautiful birds as possible and to, you know, to be put in these great places to have awesome opportunities to photograph them. So I often tell people, you know, when I'm out shooting on my own, I'm really happy if I get 1 or 2 really good images every day. Whereas I'm sure if you told your birding clients, hey, we're going to see 1 or 2 birds today, they might not be that enthused about that number. So it's a bit of a different number involved. It just shows there's sort of these, we're all out there kind of doing the same thing, but there's sort of a slightly different goal at the end of the day as to what everyone's trying to achieve.
Mm-hmm. Are birds usually your main focus on your tours? Are you looking for mammals and herps and other wildlife too?
Definitely birds are the star of the show. I kind of decided early on, you know, I didn't really want to be a sort of jack of all trades type of photographer. Mm-hmm. And I certainly didn't want to try to lead those kinds of tours just because I felt like it was harder to, you know, specialize and kind of stand out from the crowd. If you go everywhere and do everything, it's sort of harder to sort of specialize in one thing. So I kind of decided I'm going to focus on birds and I'm going to focus mostly on the New World, sort of the Americas, and try to become as well known as I can for that area. Now, with that said, like we just talked about with Brazil, if there's a jaguar and he's just sitting right there, you know, we'll stop the boat and take some pictures.
That's fair enough.
Why not?
Yeah.
Why
no, not? I mean, you know, one, I'm sure you guys
just slowly take a few minutes, folks.
Yeah, we'll just don't worry.
Stop here by the big cat, get a picture.
I'm sure you guys feel this way too, though. When you're on a trip, you know, of course, I'm trying to get people good shots and I'm trying to teach them about photography, but ultimately we're out in nature. We want to experience and explore and enjoy nature all together and have a great time doing it. And so whatever opportunities present themselves, if we're going along or walking down the trail or the road and all of a sudden some monkeys are moving through, well, we forget the birds for right now and let's see if some cool opportunities present themselves. But when they've gone, it's time to get back to the main attraction and start get back to the birds. That's sort of the way I think about mm-hmm. it.
Yeah, there's definitely like when you're guiding people, you sometimes also want to let them know when something is not an everyday situation. And it can be a common bird. I've been out on boats this last weekend. We were seeing a lot of ashy storm petrels, which are the kind of standard storm petrel here. But we were seeing them really well. And I was telling people, like, this is really a really good day for this species. And if you manage to get a photograph of an ashy storm petrel, that's much harder to do than almost any other thing that's rarer here. And people were like, oh, okay. So if you almost as a guide want to sometimes point out things that are, you know, a particularly great view of something common is part of what your job too, not just like here's a rare bird or here's, you know, I think it's people appreciate that, you know, like really great red-winged blackbird doing something, you know, it's like, let's stop and do this for a while because this is awesome.
Yeah, totally. It's funny when you get, if something is almost too easy, like some target bird, and it comes too easy and people are like, yeah, that was cool. And you're like, you have no idea how lucky you are that you just had that thing sit right perfectly in front of you for you to get a photo. But, you know, sometimes that's all right.
Yeah. Sometimes it's nice to build a little suspense on some of these, you know, like the Ross's gull. If you just, you know, if you get off the plane and it's sitting there, you're just kind of like, oh man, like, you know, the thrill of the chase really escaped us here.
Yeah.
What I'm picturing on your tours are these like 15 passenger vans and you've got all your people with the 600 F4 lenses and the tripods and all this gear that must come out and just the chaos of that. And like everyone finding all their little pieces and they maybe they're not organized and stuff's getting lost in the seats. That feels like that's another level than what it would be for birding even or a bird focused tour.
I think Molly, like they probably have like those transport planes, like a van that just opens up in the front, you know, like, and they just like deploy, you know, out of the front, you know, with all of their, you know, photos.
It's definitely harder to, like, if you're driving along and you spot something and with birding, you could kind of just jump out, grab your bins, get on it. Everyone gets a good look. That's awesome. Or maybe not even get out of the vehicle. But with photography, it's a whole nother thing. I usually give people a really good briefing, like, okay, we're moving from here to there. We are not planning to shoot on the way. You can tuck your gear away, whatever. Or we might stop. Please leave your gear out so that we can kind of disembark the bus in an orderly fashion. You're pretty much bang on, Molly, except you need to get the bus larger because everybody brings so much gear. There's always so much stuff that we need, like quite a larger vehicle than the passengers would normally. So the back of the bus is for all the gear. Everybody gets their own seat with the camera beside them, seat belted in. So sometimes it's
belted. That's funny.
You do a lot of different stuff, Glenn. You got, I see you got workshops on Ecuador, Colombia, at home in Vancouver, Costa Rica, Churchill, Brazil, which you mentioned, Costa Rica. Do you pack pretty much the same for all these trips or is it like, you know, like I bring one camera lens on pretty much every tour I do. Like I bring like my 100, 400 cause it's flexible and you know, I do the best I can with that, you know, while, you know, moving and trying to find birds. If I was really focused on photography, I don't even know what that would look like. And I'm curious how you do it.
Yeah. I mean, as far as is the kit the same for me, it is pretty much very, very, very similar for most trips. You know, most bird photographers are going to have a big lens, and that might, for many people, that's going to be a big, you know, 500 or 600 f4. Then they may have a smaller zoom lens, something like a 100 to 400 or, you know, in that realm. And then you might choose to bring a wide angle lens or a macro lens if you're kind of into some landscapes or macro stuff. But to be honest, for me, most trips, it's like my camera backpack is my big lens, a medium zoom lens, and two camera bodies, and then a few little accessories. And it's pretty much the same for most things. Some of my trips where we'll do some different techniques that might require slightly different specialized equipment, like if we're going to do, you know, hummingbird multi-flash photography, that would require a little bit of specialized packing and gets a little trickier to fit into two 50-pound checked bags. So there has to be some of my clothes and other personal items have to stay home. But, you know, I'm sure you guys probably have this too. I have a packing list that over the years has evolved. I just, before a trip, I print it out. I cross things off as I put them into a pile on the floor. I know they're all in the pile, and then I kind of carefully, you know, Tetris them into my bag and pack things in there. And that way I kind of know what I'm bringing. It's pretty much the same every time, plus or minus a couple things. So I don't want to be worried and stressed about packing. That's one thing. And inevitably there will be something that you may have forgotten or somebody will have forgotten. But the good thing is, on a photo tour, like the ones I lead, usually if you're shooting with one of the main brands, there's probably somebody else who is also shooting that brand and might be able to back you up a little bit. So it's really nice to have that. I really try on my tours to, from day one, right when we get going, to create kind of like a team environment. We're not here all as individuals. We're a team. We're working together. We're having a good time. We're making new friends. We're trying to get great shots. But let's help each other out anytime we can so that we all can achieve our goals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I always say about a guide. It's like you're part psychologist, bartender, janitor, shepherd, you know, but ultimately you are trying to create that team atmosphere and get everybody shares the same goals and wants to have a good time. So
yeah. That's the funniest thing about being a professional guide is like you'd initially think it's so much about the skill. Like it's all about being a great birder. Actually, that's probably the easiest part. It's much more like camp counselor than professional birder, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Logistics.
Yeah.
Yeah, like the packing list is key. You know, a lot of people ask about, well, what do you do? You know, how do you travel? If you have a packing list, you eliminate one whole stress thing, right? Yeah. When you're going to the airport, you're basically relaxed. You're done. Because if you trust your list and you do it well, that's it. You know, a lot of people I know, it's like, it's so stressful getting to the airport, and, you know, and did I forget something? Well, you won't forget something if you got this packing list.
Yep. If you don't put it on the list, I just had this in Brazil. I went down there, all my normal stuff, all good. And then I forgot that, you know, most of South America uses the standard kind of plugs like, you know, the United States or Canada uses, but Brazil doesn't. And I got there and I was like, oh no, didn't bring my little converter thing, adapter thing. And luckily, one of the other gentlemen on the trip, he had brought two. He was happy to lend me one and all was well.
Nice. Yeah. I also feel like Al, you were talking about the stress of packing and trusting your list and having a good list. I think having the right gear, the right luggage, the right bag. Molly, you've talked about this before. I am in the market for a new optics bag. This is something. If you guys have tips, I am all ears. And if any listeners have tips, I'm kind of in the market for a new one. The one I've got is good, but is getting run down. Anyway, food for thought. One thing I was curious about too, Glenn, is like, obviously, you know, what's the old expression? The best camera is the one you have with you, right? And now everyone's got phones and pretty like good phones, good cameras on their phone. Do you do much like phone photography stuff while you're on these trips? Or do you play around? Do you feel like you max out your phone camera's potential? And part of the reason I ask is I just got this little clip-on macro lens. Sam Gallick kind of pointed me in the direction of, he's been using it for moths, and I've just started like kind of going around trying to get like insects in the yard here. And I was like, oh man, this is a rabbit hole I could really totally go down hardcore, and I feel like really love.
I got to point out, George, I saw that misidentified fly that you thought was a bee. I was like, oh, that's rookie mistake.
The hoverfly. Yeah, it was like I forget the name, the transverse something. Yeah, but it's actually not, it's in the hoverfly family, but not called a hoverfly. But yeah.
Can't be an expert in everything, George.
Catherine Hamilton pointed it out to me. So it was a transverse banded flower fly, not a bee. Looks like a bee, people.
Yeah, you know, when I was in entomology class, you know, we had one of these exams where you had to like look at the pinned insect and identify the family. And I thought, oh, there's a trick. And it was one of these flies. So I put down the family of the fly and I got it wrong. And I was incensed, you know, and I said to the TA, that was not a bee, that was a fly. And he's like, no, well, and he said, bring out the specimen. We looked at it and he was so mad because I was right. And I was like, give me my point, man. You know, it's like, nice. It was one of those things at that point, you know, where you're just struggling for everything in school just to get by, you know.
I'll bet you didn't even care about the point. It was the principle. That. It was the principle that really.
Oh, yeah. Like, yeah. I didn't like that guy. That's the thing. He was just an obnoxious entomology guy. Whatever. Right?
Let it go, Alvaro. Let it go.
It's been 30 years. I don't know. But
as to your question, though, George, you know, I use my phone largely for, I would consider them snapshots. You know, I try to take, you know, pictures to sort of document the experience, you know, sunrises, sunsets, sometimes little videos. These days, of course, you know, with social media, it's very convenient if you can capture something on your phone and immediately post it up to your Instagram stories or whatever, rather than have to like get it off your real camera and send it over to your phone and then upload that. But as far as actual kind of high quality nature images, while the phones are getting remarkably good, and it's not only the sensor and the lens, but also the software in the phone, they're getting great. But I still think there's going to be a big gap between, like, you know, for example, in your case with the macro rig, if you went and got a nice 100mm macro and a proper, you know, mirrorless camera and used a tripod and did some focus stacking and you'd create these really, really, really stunning macro images. So there's always going to be that big jump. And of course, with birds, phones are more or less useless as far as actually taking good photos.
Right.
I guess digiscoping is kind of a thing, but a little hard for anything.
As much as anything, yeah.
Yeah, a little hard if the subject's moving. So the phones keep getting better, as do the bigger cameras. But for me, my phone is just a handy little tool that I can record a moment on. And those are nice to have, too, at the end of the trip to kind of fill in. You get all these great portfolio of nature images, really high-quality nature images. But it's nice when you get home to be able to share with your friends and family, like, oh, this is what we ate for food, and this was, oh, look at this beautiful waterfall we saw, and it's kind of nice to fill in the gaps.
Right on. Now, one of the things we talked about trying to ask you about, Glenn, is that there are a lot, like, I think Al, you might have told me that digital photography was like the most quickly adopted new technology ever. Can't remember, was you that told me that or somebody else?
I could buy that. It's hard to measure, of course, you know, yeah. But you know exactly how, but yeah, it wasn't me, but you know, it's like, you mean how the switch over from film camera.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's just, yeah. I mean, I think as soon as people saw that you could instantly see what you were getting, it just changed everything. And basically everybody became a photographer that wasn't. And so now everybody's doing it. What would you say are top tips for how, you know, average photographer can really improve their stuff?
Well, that is a big question for sure. And it's certainly going to depend on a little bit on the equipment you have. So for sure, if you want to get into taking pictures of birds, obviously, if you go out with your grandpa's old film camera and are trying to you know, have a great time and get great results, that's probably not going to go so well.
Yeah.
It's going to be a challenge. Now, with that said, I totally started with film. I started back in the film days, and I'm kind of glad that I did, because it really hammered home the principles of exposure, understanding what the camera's actually doing, understanding the basic three elements of creating a properly exposed image. So that's a good place to start for even today. Like, what can you do to make your images better? For one is, we ideally want to create a properly exposed image. So an image that, you know, isn't way too bright or way too dark. The subject looks good. And so in order to do that effectively, we need to understand that photography is ultimately just about three components. So we've got our shutter speed, which is essentially how fast the shutter opens and closes and lets light into the sensor. We've got our aperture, which is some blades inside the lens that open and close, and those control the depth of field, or how much of the image is in focus or not in focus. And obviously, if more is in focus, the aperture has to close down, and that will let less light through. And if it's wide open, as we say, that will let more light through. And then our third variable is our ISO, or our kind of the sensitivity of the what would have been film, or in this case, the digital sensor. And creating a properly exposed image is just managing those three variables. So it's just about understanding those three things. So, you know, if you're trying to photograph a peregrine falcon flying down and grabbing a shorebird, well, we're going to need a really fast shutter speed for that. So we're going to have to adjust the other two variables in order to allow us to do that. So we're probably going to want to shoot wide open, the lens maximum aperture, so that lots of light comes through. And we're probably going to have to raise our ISO to a fairly high speed so that we have a fast enough shutter speed that we can attain. But that's just one example. Ultimately, getting a properly exposed image and understanding how your camera's working. I know for me, you know, before you get into photography, it's sort of this mysterious box that just you press a button and you dial some wheels around and it works or it doesn't. But understanding those three variables is key. It's so much easier now, because literally with mirrorless cameras, you look through the viewfinder and what you're seeing is more or less what you're going to get. You don't even have to hit play on the back of the camera anymore and look at the picture. Pretty much what you're seeing through the viewfinder is what you're going to get. So you can get a bit lazy and not really understand what's actually going on. But I think every photographer would serve themselves well to understand the fundamentals of exposure theory, at least at that basic level. And it's not hard. It's not complicated. So that's one thing. I would say that probably the biggest thing that I see in other people's images that kind of maybe lets them down a little bit is not really understanding light. I think that's a real fundamental thing, that you have to understand light in order to become a good photographer. You have to understand that light has a quality about it. You know, think about an early sunrise. You get up out on the tundra early in the morning and you look at your shadow and it's like 60 feet long and you have that beautiful low angle golden light. On the other hand, think about a snapshot that you've taken. Like, for example, George in our little video here is wearing a hat. And imagine if it's high noon and you went outside and it's a sunny day and you took a picture, you're going to see this giant shadow on your face. And the same thing happens with birds or other animals, monkeys, jaguars. We have to understand that light has quality, light has direction, light has color. And if we're not tuned into that and we're not paying attention to the directionality and the quality of the light, we're basically just hoping for the best when we take these pictures. So the light is so, so important. And then I think some of the other things that people, I won't, you know, go on here for too long, but I think things that people should pay attention to when it comes to bird photography, composition is very important. There's no really hard and fast rules about what makes a well-composed image. But for me, a well-composed image is an image that looks in balance. So when you look at the image, whether it's, you know, just a bird on a stick or a bird flying, or maybe there's a bird on a stick with some other bits of foliage or things in the background. But when you look at it, things look to be balanced and it's a sort of harmonious image to look at. Where the sort of, I guess, people who get more serious about bird photography start to really pay a lot of attention to that perch. What the perch is a big part of the image ultimately. And while the image can be in focus and properly exposed and shot in good light, if it's sitting on a chain link fence, it kind of falls short as being a beautiful natural history image. in my opinion. So I pay a lot of attention to what birds are perched on. And if they're, you know, around a feeder or something like that, I'm going to try to make sure that they're landing on something beautiful. The background is really important. So a lot of people, when you start out, you're just happy. Look, the bird is in focus. He's more or less properly exposed. He's in the middle of the frame. What more do you want from me? But as you move on, you start noticing, oh, well, that shorebird that was on the beach there, it's got a, you know, can of Dr. Pepper right behind him on the beach. And that's not really helping the image overall. So those are some things that I think people could really pay attention to. And then once you've kind of mastered all those things, there's always that sort of dynamic, let's say, an X factor to a shot. So that's when you get those wow photos that maybe you go on a trip and there's those one or two photos that really stood out. Maybe you got some fantastic action, or the setting was just so beautiful. Maybe it was, a penguin in Antarctica and the snow started coming down and the bird called, or some special moment, birds that are feeding or mating or doing something interesting. Then that's going to take those images up to the next level. So it's just sort of building the foundations and then looking for those special moments. I don't know if that answered the question, but that's sort of some things to think about.
Yeah, no, that is great. And I think your point about light is actually something that a lot, particularly new birders, I think, but even, you know, people that have been doing it for a while, people don't realize how much light can play tricks on them and make birds appear in ways that they wouldn't normally look, or just really change their appearance. Light and angle are huge, huge variables. And I do think too that I didn't start out really a photographer. I don't really consider myself a photographer. I'm just somebody who likes to take pictures while I'm out in the field. And I think that it's interesting what photography can teach you about your subject. You notice after a while, you're like, okay, you know, maybe you're following a shorebird on a beach, or you're tracking a bird in the air, and all of a sudden you're like, this bird, it's going left right now, but it's going to start to track right, and you know, it might come right here, and you can just I think you start to pay attention more to. You can start to intuit what some of these birds are going to do if, you know, because of what you learn while trying to photograph them, because you think, oh, this thing is going away. You know, so many times you're like, this thing is not doing what I want when I want it to. And sometimes you think it's about to jump left. And when it does, it's going to be in a perfect spot for viewing and photography. So that's one thing I might bring up just is that you can actually learn, not only can you analyze your photos later and look at them and really appreciate things that you would never really have noticed in the field, but you can actually start to kind of anticipate these birds' behavior more.
No, that's a great point. I mean, that's one of the things that as you spend more and more time in the field as a photographer, that's going to take you even up to that next level and get more repeatable, reliable results. I'm always telling people, you're always looking for patterns. You're looking for repeatable things that you might notice. You're looking for predictable behaviors. And the more you know about birds, the more you understand their behavior, the more you're going to be able to see those things. A really good example that just came to mind while you were speaking. So as we mentioned, I was just down in Brazil. One of the lodges we go to had this very large, impressive fig tree with lots of fruits on it. And in the first afternoon that we arrived, I noticed that there were some magnificent toco toucans feeding from this tree. And so we got a few shots, but the light was fading and, you know, they moved on. The next afternoon, one of the clients and I were off over on the side, and we saw the toco toucans fly into a different tree that was, you know, a couple hundred meters away from that fig tree. We were completely in the wrong position to get good photos of it. And right away, I could see the client kind of getting their camera ready. And I was like, no, come with me. Run over here. And we literally ran over. I just had him follow me to get ourselves in a line between where the birds were and where I knew they were going. I know they're going to that fig tree. I just saw them feeding there. So I'm running to get the light angle behind me. And I said, get ready, pre-focus on that tree. They're going to fly. And not a minute later, these two toco toucans flew out of that tree towards the fig tree. We were in the perfect spot, and we both nailed fantastic shots of these toco toucans flying past us. So that's a really good example of sort of your knowledge, your paying attention, your understanding of bird behavior, your understanding of light, and ultimately leading towards getting the results you're after.
Getting the shot.
Nailing the shot.
Yeah. You know, I was asked to be part of a panel that was for a photo contest, nature bird photo contest. It was a Chilean group of photographers and birders. And I picked a whole bunch of amazing photos as my top five or whatever. And none of them won. And I realized that what I was seeing in the photos was not what the other panelists, some of them who were actually photographers, were seeing. And I thought that was really interesting, like as a lesson for how we see the world and what we find interesting or beautiful.
Yeah.
And one of the things that occurred to me is that I knew the birds, and I knew, like, there was one picture of slender-billed parakeets bathing, and they were sort of, you know, they were kind of jumping up from water and bathing. I've never seen one of those birds bathing, let alone, you know, a good photograph of that. To me, that was so special that it deserved, you know, top mention. But the ones that won were the technically sort of more proficient, you know, bird side on view. To me, those were boring.
Yeah.
They were not telling me very much about the bird. And also, I don't know, it's probably wrong to say, but it seems to me that it's easier to get technically proficient than to have an eye for something unusual.
Absolutely. Right?
And I was going for the unusual, and they were great photos. Like, don't get me wrong. They were, but they weren't the classic. And I thought, isn't that interesting how we saw these same images totally differently? And the, you know, and I thought, wow, what do you say to somebody who wants to, like, how do you learn to get that super cool story rather than just a really proficient, nicely lit image of a bird on its side, you know, kind of side view?
For the listeners, George is currently distracted. He's birding out his window. He's not paying attention to Alvaro's important question.
No, he never does.
There's a juvenile chipping sparrow, and I was like, "What is that?" And had to give it a check. You know,
fair enough.
Check. Yeah.
But back to the regularly scheduled program with Alvaro's question. I think that if you are understanding those variables we talked about, and you are creating, like, ideally in the situation that you're talking about, this contest, the winning photo would be one that's both technically, you know, proficient and showing something interesting, not one or the other. You know what I mean? Not just a beautiful photo of that bird sitting on a nice perch and everything's like, those are kind of the bar is set there to create a beautiful image. But then, like I was saying, we're looking for those opportunities to go past the bar and to look for a special moment or capturing some dynamic event, or, you know, to create, like you saw that in that image, because you know that that's not that common. And that's, you'd be really lucky to be able to see that and get a picture of that. But if it was in really harsh light, or, I mean, I obviously haven't seen the photo, then it's sort of, right. It was like an almost. Now, the way I would think about that, if I was, let's say I lived near that site, I'd be thinking, okay, I've seen that these birds come down and they're bathing here. I wonder if they'll do that again tomorrow. Maybe I can come back here with better light, in better conditions, put myself in a good position to take a picture of this behavioral thing that I've now seen, but can I do it in a really beautiful and technically perfect way? So that's the kind of way that I would be thinking about things, those things. If, of course, maybe they never come back there again ever, but in order to create the truly special shots, sometimes you need a couple attempts. Here's a good example of that. So we have these beautiful violet green swallows where I live. Mm. One of my favorite swallows. They're so stunning. You almost,
they really are.
And it's also a perfect example of a bird that you can't even really appreciate unless you've seen a good photo of them, because they fly past you. And you kind of see a flash of color, similar to hummingbirds too, where you just see this, wow, what was that? That was amazing, but it's gone. And these violet green swallows, I had some okay shots of them, of perched birds and stuff like that. But when these newer mirrorless cameras came out and there was a clear jump in the autofocus capabilities, right when I got the camera that I use now, I was like, wow, this opens some doors. I think I can nail a really awesome shot of these violet green swallows, but I need to find the right spot. I need to find the right conditions, and I need everything has to come together to get the shot that I'm after, because I don't want most shots you see of swallows. They're quite far away. And so if somebody's got, yes, they're in focus, you've got a lot of megapixels, you can crop in and still get a decent image to present on the web. But you can tell if you look at the image, the whole bird is completely in focus, suggesting that it's far away and it's a huge crop. Whereas if you have the bird quite close to you and, you know, really, truly large in the frame, lots of megapixels, you'll still see the depth of field kind of fall off towards the wingtips. Anyways, I went around town. Now, the birds are not hard to find. They're quite common, but finding the right spot. I tried 6, 7, 8 different locations trying to get shots, nothing working out. I finally found a good site, and I kept going back there night after night. Finally, I got the right kind of barometric conditions that the insects were really low to the water. There was a nice stiff wind that the birds had to fly into in order for me to get the right light angle, so that it really slowed them down and made it a lot easier. And all my best photos came from that one night, and ultimately got some really cool shots. We need some like visuals here. I need to be able to like show you this photo.
I'm imagining it. Yeah,
I know. And that's a bird. Yeah. I did 3 trips out west this summer, and like I was like, I really want a good photograph of that bird. Failed miserably, I might add.
Yeah, they're tough because they often don't perch super low either. They will sometimes near a nest spot, but you have to find it. If you want a nice perch shot, you got to find a good location, like often like a cliff or something where you can get close to where they're roosting, or and in flight, definitely swallows. It's one of those things where you really can't necessarily plan it, because if you go there and they might be feeding, you know, 0.5 kilometer up in the air where the insects are flying around. So it's like, well, that's not gonna work out. So you need repetition, and you need to either get really lucky or be very, very, persevere and keep going back.
Yeah. Someday me and the violet green swallow, we'll get it sorted out.
Come on out to Victoria. Yeah. We'll get you one.
Well, so you were talking earlier about, getting photos quickly off of a phone, from the camera side. I took off to Arizona last week before, which is a trip I do every year, and was getting on the plane realizing I haven't edited my photos from last year from Arizona. So I would love to hear, because I'm sure you take way more photos than I do. First off, how set some expectations here. Like, how quickly are you processing your photos? And would love to hear some secrets on how you get those into a catalog quickly.
Yeah, that's a great question. And it is a bit different for every person, but I will certainly tell you what I like to do. So these days, the cameras can take a lot of pictures. You know, we have digital cameras. They can shoot at very fast frame rates. The top of the line pro bodies, many of which are shooting, you know, Sony A1 or a Canon R3, those are shooting at 30 frames a second. So you can imagine some mountain toucan flies in and lands on the perch and he's doing something. You know, the volumes of pictures that people will be taking. It's not uncommon for people to come on my tours and take 50,000 photos.
Whoa. Yeah.
They used to talk about spray and pray, and now it's like, yeah, you almost can't not do that, right? It's like,
yeah, totally. So you're going to, all that to say, you're going to wind up with a high volume of images to go through. And let's say at least 2,000 to 3,000 a day, most likely on one of my photo trips. And what I tell people is you should delete at least 90% of those. At least 90% should be gone from your memory cards. Like, so what I do and what I encourage people to do. Now, with that said, it's different for everybody. Some people like to keep everything until they get home, and then they go through them and they have a whole system of how that works for them. But I think that what most people do is they get home with 50,000 photos. All of a sudden life comes calling, you know, family, house, you know, friends, obligations, things are happening. Time goes by and they may or may not even remember what they shot or to go back and go through it. So let's forget about that side of the coin. Let me tell you how I do it, which is how I would encourage people to do it. So first of all, it's great if you have time and energy at the end of the day to download your images from the card and at least get them backed up, because, you know, it would be terrible to lose all of your photos from a trip. So it's always a good idea to download them onto your computer and back them up onto another drive of some sort. And not a bad idea to even do 2 backups, but at least 1 backup. after that, I think it's a really good idea to have a fairly quick program of which you can go through them and what I call culling. So basically, when I'm doing it, I'll you know, drag a whole day's shots on, and I open up a program that just allows me to quickly preview them. Some programs, and depending on how fast your laptop is, it can be kind of a slow process for them to render. Like Lightroom, for example, mm-hmm. has been worse. It's getting better, but it's kind of notoriously slow for the images to come up and render. So I use a program that I love called Breeze Browser, and it allows me to go through them really quick. And the first pass through is a binary decision. It's not, what do I like about this image? Ooh, look at that pose. None of that. It's simply, it's a yes or a maybe, or it's a hard no. So bird was looking away, bird's totally out of focus, something in the way, terrible pose. And I just have one finger on the delete button and one finger on the arrow to the right to advance me to the next photo. And it's literally less than 1 second decision for each. It's just delete, 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 maybe delete, delete, delete. Oh, that's a good one. Delete, 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 delete. And I'm just hammering through those, let's say 2000 photos. And usually, honestly, you can cut it at least in half that first. And that should only take, 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. The second pass, I'll go through and do kind of the same thing again, but now you've got more confidence, because the first pass, you were keeping some stuff that you weren't. You're like, oh, I better keep that one just in case I didn't get anything better. And then you've just looked at what you shot. And you're like, no, I know I got some really great ones of that Toco toucan later. I don't need to keep all these B-grade ones. So you do it again quickly. Now, that would be even quicker because you're going through half as many photos. And now you've got it down to maybe 70% has been deleted. Now we can dig in a little bit and we can start. You're still going to have a lot of similar images. So maybe you rattled off at 10 or 20 or 30 frames a second when that bird landed on the perch, and they're all in focus. They all look pretty good. Do you need 26 shots of the same bird on the same perch in the pretty much the same pose? I don't think you do.
Oh, but so you can agonize for hours over which.
You can.
Yeah.
And this is where it gets hard. This is where it gets hard because you have to actually know what you're looking for. So, having the kind of confidence to delete 25 of those 26 and know that that's the one I really like. That's the best one. That's the one I want to polish up and present to the world. But that will get you down there into that kind of 90% deleted as you go through and do that. And another thing that I like to do is once I've deleted a fair bit and got it down to just a few hundred shots, I'll really quickly do what I call batch renaming the images. So most of these programs will have a way that you can select a whole bunch of files, quickly type in, Toco toucan, redneck tanager, whatever. And the reason I like to do that is, especially when you're shooting at feeders, you can imagine you guys have been to places in Colombia and stuff where you have a set of birds that are coming in throughout the day. So you might have, photographed a blue-gray tanager throughout the day multiple times. And the tendency as you're going through your photos will be to keep the best couple from each time you saw the bird. But what if most of those weren't that good? And only the last two times did he come in and really land somewhere nice. Or maybe it was a ratty individual, the first few that you photographed. So when you rename them, all the alphabetical ones are together. So all your blue-gray tanagers are together. It also allows you to say, look, I still got 27 blue-gray tanagers from today. And that's just too many. I don't need that many. So you can be ruthless just on that one species and go, what's the best five? That's all I'm keeping. Okay, great. All the rest of these are in the bin. Let's move on. Time for bed. Good day's work. And then maybe if you shot 2000, you got it down to 20 to 50 images, and that's your day's work. And that's something you can actually manage. So if you do that throughout the trip, you go home with a couple hundred great photos that you can then polish up and do your image editing on. If you go home with 50,000, you got some work to do.
It's worth saying too, mm-hmm. that Glenn, you've got a series of eBooks on post-processing. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the program that most people still use to edit their images is Adobe Photoshop, and it can be a very daunting program. I know it was for me when I first started learning. And then as I started teaching, of course, everybody on the trips wants to learn about Photoshop, but you have a very limited time to teach people after a whole day of birding and shooting and editing and eating and all the things. You don't really have a lot of time. So I've developed sort of a kind of curriculum of eBooks that are very valuable for anybody who's into, high-end nature photography and wants to sort of, what you definitely don't want to do is go to your library or bookstore and buy the Idiot's Guide to Photoshop that's, you know, 700 pages of so much stuff that you do not need to know. Everybody needs to understand just some basic stuff. They can make a basic workflow to get them from sort of raw image to sort of a presentable, slightly polished up. And then the sky's the limit in Photoshop as far as how far you want to take it and how you want to enhance your skill set. We've used a few woodworking analogies already since Molly wanted to ask me about woodworking later, but it's like anything. You know, the first time you sit down with Photoshop, are you going to be able to do as good of a job as I would be? Of course not. And if I went to some master furniture maker's shop and said, I want to make something like you, I'm not going to be able to, or I want to learn to play the guitar, I'm going to go take one lesson for 2 hours and all of a sudden I'm going to be rocking away. Of course not. You have to practice. You have to learn some stuff. But you can get pretty proficient with a basic set of skills and a nice basic workflow that will get people there. And then you can take it wherever you want to go from there.
I think it's pretty cool that having an author of a series for something like that, that has experience doing birding photography focused trips. I mean, that's massive compared to looking at some sort of generalist workflow resource that is working the same for, you know, any type of photography. I imagine that's really helpful.
Yeah. I've gotten great feedback over the years and many people have, it's sort of their Photoshop Bible. So I'm sure we can put some links in the show notes or whatever to some of those, to my website or whatever, whatever works.
We can do that. Yeah, well, woodworking, I wanted to ask you about that. That is quite analogous. You kind of have like whatever set of tools that is at your disposal or that you want to collect for that. And then you can do whatever you, I mean, you can take that as far as you want too. That's a cool comparison. Saying this is a very beginner pseudo woodworker that dabbles occasionally, but I'm very interested in it.
Except you don't have the history thing where you can go back, right? Because like, oh yeah. No, you know, I messed
yeah,
it
no
up.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yes.
Molly, measure twice.
Good tips.
No kidding. No backups there.
I couldn't build a bookshelf, so, you know.
Let me flip the script on you guys here. Now, you guys, you know, are mostly obviously birders, but you guys have cameras. I've seen your guys' Instagram and whatnot, and you're out there taking pictures. So what do you guys find to be sort of the most challenging aspects of photography? Or if we all had a private workshop off somewhere exciting together, what would you be asking me about photography?
I can tell, I mean, for me, I could stand to improve in a whole host of ways, but like, that's not the part that bothers me. It is the post-processing part and the organizing of imagery afterwards. And so that actually, I think Al is pretty good with, cause I know you're organized that way, Al. I'm not so much, but that's probably where I would be trying to pick your brain, Glenn, would be trying to deal with the, you know, after getting home and dealing with it. So I've actually been taking notes as you've been going here. I'm going to get me some Breeze browser and
I saw you writing that down.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I'm going to send you guys all a copy of my ebook on post-processing so you can practice away.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
Yeah. I've used Breeze browser and I didn't get used to it though. Maybe I got to learn how to use it better. But as we use some of these things.
There's another one that's similar. I forget that a friend of mine recommended that I forget the name of, but it's the same idea as it basically allows you to cull a lot of stuff quickly because Lightroom takes a long time to load all that stuff up. And so I do think that would help me a lot is getting going on that.
Now, one thing just I should mention, Breeze browser is only available for PC users.
Oh.
So if you're a Mac person, but the good news is I have another suggestion for Mac people. There is another one which is called Fast Raw Viewer, and it is also very fast. It's largely the same. You know, obviously the interface is slightly different, but these are specialist programs that are good at doing one thing and doing it well. They're good at loading the images quickly, allowing you to make those decisions, delete or keep, and maybe do some batch renaming, and that's it. And then you're going to move on to a different program to start the next part of your post-processing journey.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. I'm thinking through how that works. I use Lightroom, which I don't sort in Lightroom. I also have a Mac. I sort on like the standard Mac browser first and just do some quick tagging and then pull into Lightroom. But the renaming part is the most intimidating for me, I think, because a lot of times when I'm doing something birding related, I'm taking pictures of tons of species at once. You know, you're like mixing through, you're just kind of taking pictures as you're on your walk or whatever. And I typically rename. Well, I don't rename until I export my keepers, but that would be a really helpful way to flip it from the beginning.
You know, I don't rename anything because I make the tags, you know, searchable tag. I have this big, you know, thousands of tags on Lightroom that I tag the photo and then I can search on it. So I know that I'm always searching for, you know, first cycle Western gull or something like that. So I have all that stuff and I can choose in flight when it, but it means that I have to tag everything.
Yeah.
But then I don't, you know, I don't rename.
I think when it comes to how people organize their files, whether it's renaming or tagging, it's there's no way to do it. There's no one way to do it. And what we have to recognize is we're all different. You know, if we all opened up our clothes cupboards in our rooms, Alvaro's in his bedroom now, right? But yeah. We would all organize our things differently. My library behind me would be differently organized than George's. You know, we are all different. What's important about how you organize and store your files is if, let's say, you were on a trip and then 10 years from now, I said, hey, Alvaro, you remember that awesome shot you got of the slender-billed parakeet? Can we look at that one? And if you have to go, oh, well, did I put that under the chili or the birds or parrots or 2027 or where? Oh, I don't remember where that is. You don't have a good system. If you can say, oh, yeah, sure, let's bring it up. Here we go. I'm going to use my Lightroom catalog. I'm going to type in slender-billed parakeet, and there he is. That's great. You have a system that works for you. And so that's what matters. It doesn't really matter how you do it. We all think differently. It just matters that you have a system that works. That's what's important, I think.
For just a minute, I thought you were going to say slender-billed curlew. And I was like, wow, that has a photo of a slender-billed curlew?
Sorry. But it's exactly what I'm often... You know, I'm often taking photographs for reference so that I can figure out identification features, right? So I want to have a lot. I probably keep more than a photographer would because I want to see that scapular, whatever. But I need to have them searchable in a way that I can say, okay, I'm going to pull up all of my, you know, this, and I'm going to compare them to that. So I need to do that quickly. So that's why I invested a ton of time to do that. But I know if you already have, you know, 50,000 photos, this would be a nightmare to sort of start, unless you start from today and move forward. And then, you know, but I'm so glad I did because I can get that slender-billed curlew photograph that I know.
Yeah, and I think your use case is kind of different than most people's in that, you know, you're an author of some field guides and you're doing a lot of sort of identification at a very specific level that most people probably wouldn't. But most people listening to this are probably in the sort of birder category where they want to take some nice pictures to show their friends when they get home. And it will probably serve them well to have, look, no, none of your friends want to sit through a slideshow of 50,000 photos. I'll tell you that right now.
I've been there. I've seen those slideshows. Oh,
no, the worst. So
here's another shot of the Toko toucan.
That's not the good one. Let me wait. I know where the good one is somewhere. No. So do yourself and do your friends a favor and have some way of organizing them. And I just think, yeah, in general, most people keep way too many photos. They're afraid to delete them. We've really been rattling on about sort of file organization and things like that. But for most people who go on a trip, they want to come home with a nice tight little portfolio of some of the beautiful birds that they saw. And so just finding a way to get there, that's the key.
One thing I wanted to ask, I was talking about with a friend recently who has submitted to various photo contests.
Asking for a friend, are you?
Yeah. Yeah, a friend, quote unquote. Yeah. But I was surprised I shouldn't be surprised, I guess, right? But with AI, with everything happening now, like, is denoise okay? Is that like, is it ethical to denoise your imagery a little bit, a lot? Like, what's the, like, at what point are we really altering the image to a point that it's not what it was? I don't know where, I don't know, like, you know, that's a big question, and obviously, but I was surprised at it's some of the stuff that I guess can't be used if you're planning to submit to some of these photo contests.
Yeah, so that's interesting. So I will start by saying that I never enter photo contests, largely because, yeah, they're so subjective. And now, that's not to say, by all means, if people enjoy doing that, please go ahead. But to me, it's kind of silly from what I'm trying to achieve. So if I go out and I spend all this money to fly to some far-flung part of the world, and I've spent days, weeks, months trying to photograph to get an image of this bird, and he pops onto a branch for 4 seconds and gives me one crack at him, and I manage to actually get a half decent photo, you know, as long as I'm not altering reality of what that bird actually looks like, oh, he's a, you know, a green bird, let's just make him a little more blue, you know, if we're not actually changing the nature of what you would see, the reality, then to me, it's all fair game. So if there's a little, like I say, like if you got this one photo of this super rare bird, but unfortunately right behind his head was a little really, really, really ugly twig, I'm taking that twig out. You know, I want people to see how beautiful that bird is and how amazing of an animal that is. And if there's something really distracting in the photo, to me, it's gone. I don't think that's, in the purist, a photo purist say, well, you know, that really wasn't there. It's like, okay, well, you enjoy looking at your crappy photo then, and I will look at my nice photo. Now I get it when it comes to a photo contest, obviously if they have to judge it, if it's, you know, BBC Wildlife Photographer of the Year or whatever, there's a reason why they have those rules, and I get it. But as far as what I'm trying to present to the world, I want to take pictures of these beautiful birds, and I want people to see them and appreciate them and enjoy them. And as long as the bird still looks just like the bird, that's where I land on that.
Mm-hmm. Have you guys seen that baby peacock image that's going around?
Is it one of these fake ones where it's
like, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like the beautiful baby, and it's like it's crazy, and it's all, you know, generators. And people believe this is what a baby peacock looks
like. They do it with owls. They do, like, some of them I actually really find infuriating. Like, they get massive, massive responses. And I'm like,
look at the beautiful baby owl.
I'm like, that's not a bird. Like, you know, that thing is a cartoon character.
But then there's some birds that are so beautiful that people don't believe they're real. And this is where we get into this. I noticed I was on Facebook the other day, and one of these birding pages had shared some old photo of mine of a lemon-throated barbet, which is like a pretty stunning bird. And the first comment was, guys, that's not a real bird. Don't fall for it. And I was like,
birds aren't real.
And I was like, okay, well.
What's that pigeon, you know, the pigeon that's orange, you know, with a green head or whatever, it's like from New Guinea or something.
Fiji or something.
And you see a photo of this thing, and it's shaped like this ball. You think, there's no way that thing's real. Then you realize, no, that's real.
One day I might see that, I hope.
You know?
Yeah, that thing is crazy looking. It's like a sherbet.
I think in this kind of conversation, what's more, I guess, concerning or threatening to people like myself who are photographers is, how good is AI going to get to the point where you could just say, you know, make me the most beautiful photo of
ivory-billed woodpecker,
and it just takes every single image on the internet and figures out a way to make knowing what is conceived to be a good photo, and it can actually do that.
Yeah, because this is not it's a when, right? I mean,
totally. Yeah. However, in order for it to do that, so for example, you could do that with a blue jay, or, you know, anything that there is a lot of source material, right? So if there already are millions of photos to pull from, but then you go to some of these really rare species where there for the, there's a lot of birds that there are still very few good images of.
Yeah.
And so, well, yeah.
No, I'd flip it around. That's why I'm photographing house sparrows in my backyard and trying to get really good images, because there's not going to be many source material. Nobody takes a photograph at all. You know, so it's really, really common and ugly, and nobody has photos. You know, it's interesting mm-hmm. that too, isn't it? You know, we are drawn to the beautiful and then the rare, and there's some things that are common and dull that nobody photographs. You know,
yeah.
Like, juvenile chipping sparrows.
You know, it's funny, as a birder, you guys have probably felt this, and I certainly have as a photographer. Initially, you're drawn to the most flamboyant, showy, spectacular birds. And of course, we still love those guys too. But as you go on, you're way more excited about the super rare little ant bird or ant pitta or whatever that a non-birder would be like, that's what you flew to Colombia for? But... You know, we appreciate the more nuanced kind of special little birds as we go on in our journeys.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of like the wine thing, you know?
Yeah. Hey, how about this for a question for you guys? What's the favorite bird or your favorite bird photo that you guys have ever captured?
Oh, juicy. That's good. I don't have a clear one.
I think sometimes when you get a really good photograph of something in flight.
Oh yeah.
I find those are, because they show that you were just out in the field and you were just paying attention and you were also ready, you know, and I feel like that is sort of the epitome of the birder photographer versus maybe the photographer who is more keyed in and has a setup and it is, you know, it's really paying attention to getting a great photo. The birder photographer is sort of just ready to go at any one point when something goes by.
Right. You still have to actually be
get
lucky,
something. But you have to be lucky.
Yeah.
You know, because you're not set up really. You just have to like, you know.
But that's what makes it special, because when you look at it and you're like, oh my God, I got one.
Oh, yeah. That's exactly. I'm not remembering very specific, you know, I think I have like some doves or something, like, you know, bantail pigeon or something flying around where it's like, yes, you know.
Yeah.
Nice. So I think that's what I feel I like.
Yeah. What about you, Molly? Any standout for you?
You know, I've been thinking throughout our whole conversation, photography to be something that you do long term and you put as much time and effort and skill building into as a lot of people do, like, it has to be something deeply personal to you to really feel fulfilled about it, you know? So I was thinking about a lot of photos that have very strong memories for me. My grandma got me started in photography. So the first thing I thought of was a photo I took when I was like 8 of Canada geese taking off of a pond on my family's farm. That is by no means a quality photo whatsoever, but I really, really thought it was at that point. And I entered in kids photo contests like a long time ago and never won anything on it. But I still think about that. I think my grandma still has that framed in her house. But a recent-ish photo, it's like a year old, that I am fond of, is one of my favorite birds too, is a common raven that I took in Bryce Canyon. And it's just a profile shot. And I really like photographing corvids and blackbirds, which I find very challenging, but it's one that I just enjoy the memory. I was road tripping with Josh Coville heading down to Arizona last year actually, and got that as we were making a stop. So it was just such a fun few days, and it was my first time driving through a couple of those western states and hitting up some of, you know, the national parks and that sort of thing. So it's like all of that tied up to a bird that I really like and lighting that was exceptionally good for a blackbird on a trip that I liked and a fun moment and all of that. So that's one good photo I like.
And that's kind of what it's all about, you know, whether it's birding or photography, it's just a reason for us to go out in nature, you know, whether making a list or we're getting some photos or... It's a reason for us to spend more time out in nature, to be more connected to the natural world. And so, yeah, I think that's a great answer with the sort of sentimental aspect of it. I feel like most of the photos that I wind up keeping, if you showed me them, I could probably almost tell you right away, where was that? What were, you know, mm-hmm. when was that? Where was it? Because you've, it kind of freezes that moment and that snapshot. And the, in some ways, the pursuit of what we're doing is kind of silly, you know, flying around the world to see these birds. But it gives us a goal to go out and spend thousands of hours out in nature, you know, spending time with these animals and trying to understand nature in a better way. So, yeah, I like that answer.
Yeah, and, totally. And Molly, those, I think that when you get a really good, like, let's say Brewer's blackbird or common grackle photo that's lit so you can see that iridescence, you think like, wow, you know, because most of the time they just look black, and then you see those amazing colors, and if you capture it on a photo, people cannot believe that bird is real. And then you say, and not only real, it's in your backyard every day.
Yeah.
You just haven't seen that aspect of it. It's almost like, you know, it's like when a friend of yours, you know, you realize they can sing and you're like, what? You know, like, all these years I've known you and now you break open the song. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, talking about house sparrows or starlings.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some beautiful birds.
Good looking birds.
Yeah.
That aspect, Alvaro, is what made me fall in love with photographing hummingbirds, because there's two aspects to it too. There's the iridescence, which is in many species just flashed for a moment, and you want more. You know, you see it, it's beautiful, it's gone. You want to see more of that, and your eyes are always left wanting. You know, and then there's the flight aspect, which is like you cannot see their wings even moving. It's sort of this mysterious thing, and then when you can actually take a picture that you can just stare at and you can study and you can enjoy and you can just sort of drink it all in and appreciate how unbelievable they are. That's one of the things that got me super hooked on bird photography from the start, is just this ability to kind of freeze a moment and then really enjoy it afterwards.
Yeah. Then their feathers look almost like metal scales, you know, they look like these warriors when you see a hummingbird frozen, you know, like, wow, they don't look like birds.
No.
And you think about the evolution, you go down to the Andes and you think about, you know, why did all these different types come to be? And, you know, you think about the sort of genetic mutations responsible for all these unbelievable patterns of iridescence and, you know, the sexual selection that would have driven all these ornate plumages and long tails and crazy crests, and they're just a fantastic group of birds.
Oh yeah, yeah, the best.
Yep. One of my recent favorite photos that I took was of an indigo capped hummingbird, an endemic to Colombia, and that's what I liked about it, was you could see that structure and color, and structural color, I guess. And we haven't mentioned the book, Glenn, Hummingbirds, A Celebration of Nature's Jewels by Glenn Bartley and Andy Swash.
I was teeing you up for a segue there, George.
Yes, nicely done. True professional. Yeah. That is an amazing book. I handed it off to I got a copy, handed off to my father as well, who is a serious book aficionado. He loved it. We put the review on the Hillstar Nature site under our book reviews,
awesome
section. And it is a masterpiece. And the imagery is otherworldly. What was, maybe tell folks a little bit about the book and what that process was like building that book.
Yes. Well, anybody who's ever done a book knows it takes longer than you think it will and is a lot more work. But no, from when I started falling in love with birds, and especially neotropical birds, I always knew hummingbirds always had a special place in my heart. I love photographing them, trying to find new and interesting ways to photograph them. And I knew that a big goal was always going to be to do a hummingbirds book. And yada, 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 a few years ago, the pieces came together and Princeton University Press, you know, was willing to publish this book. So my co-author Andy and I, we started, it was actually a fantastic pandemic project, because as you guys know very well, we weren't doing a lot of traveling there for a while. And it was a great project to have during that period of time to really pull together the images, which are largely my images. But I wanted this book to be the most beautiful, informative, interesting book about hummingbirds that exists. And so I'm not, you know, vain enough to say they have to be all my photos. So I scoured the internet to try to find, if we're missing a really showy species, I will try to find that photo if it exists. And if we need a certain photo to show a certain behavior, I will try to find it. And so we put this book together that we're really proud of, and we think it shows off the hummingbirds to the maximum of their ability, with lots of great photos, but also, you know, I think very well written and easily read text that just walks you through how amazing these hummingbirds are. We've got some fantastic artwork in there from a Dutch illustrator who I found on Instagram, and she did a fantastic job. Because I just knew there's going to be some things that I'm not going to be able to photograph, or that are just better represented graphically in a drawing. So things like, for example, a hummingbird grabbing an insect out of the air. Well, good luck photographing.
I tried today and failed, by the way.
Yeah. It's going to be very tough. Yeah. And also just in terms of visually, I think where some books, at least in my opinion, fall short is, while they have really beautiful images, it gets a bit repetitive, you know, by page 30, 40, 50, if it was nothing but colorful full page images. So in my mind, it was like, we want to mix in really nice text, but then to complement these colorful photos, let's have some sort of black and white drawings that really show how does a hummingbird fly and how do they eat? And let's take a look at some really different bill shapes and that kind of thing. So we tried to make it as visually interesting as possible and have some great information, all the most up-to-date conservation status and taxonomy and everything like that. So we're really proud of it. And I think if you're a hummingbird lover and you don't have a copy, you should go out and get one.
Absolutely. No, really a fantastic book. Yeah, well said. Yeah. We should let you get back to real life here, Glenn.
To taking great pictures.
To taking pictures, yeah.
Have you got anything coming up that folks should know about?
Yeah, well, I guess I'll just say, if people want to see some more of my work, head on over to my website, which is just my name. So it's just Glenn with two N's, Bartley.com. And we can probably put it in the show notes. And there you can find out whatever you want to know about me as far as tours that I have coming up, ebooks. If you are a budding bird photographer and you enjoy kind of watching YouTube videos, you could check out The Bird Photography Show, which is on YouTube. My friend Jan Wegener and I have a kind of every other week we do a show about bird photography. It's kind of fun. And if you want to learn a bit more about bird photography, that could be a good resource. And of course, check out the Hummingbirds book. And yeah, those are kind of what's going on in my life. My next trips, I'm going off to Antarctica, where I know you guys were last season. So I'm headed down there in October to sort of bit of Patagonia, bit of South Georgia, bit of Antarctica, bit of Falklands.
Oh, wow.
And then I'll fly home for like maybe 10 days and then back down to Argentina for a personal shoot, which is I'm really excited about, because I haven't really been in that sort of Chaco and those dry kind of forests of Argentina. So hopefully that'll be a good shoot. And then it gets into full-on tour mode with workshops throughout the spring. So that's what's going on in my life. So like I said, calm before the storm.
Nice. Wow. That sounds awesome.
Making Canada proud, Glenn.
Yeah. Yes. I look forward to seeing those Argentina shots. I mean, that's going to be fantastic. Yeah. But yes, thank you as well for the Canadian content. Alvaro has really been advocating hard on this.
Yeah. Alvaro, can we get this on the CBC?
Maybe, yeah, yeah. Yeah, and that's not a Christmas bird count for you Americans. It's the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. That's right. Yeah, we can certainly, yeah, I will pull strings too, of course. You know.
Nice. Well, thank you guys so much for having me. I hopefully the audience enjoyed a little bit of photography talk. And if you guys get good feedback and you ever want to do another photo themed episode, I'd be happy to come back and we can dig into some other topics in more depth.
That'd be fantastic.
Cool, yeah. 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 This has been the best.
Yeah.
Love it.
Thanks so much, Glenn. Thanks everybody for listening. We'll be back again soon, everybody. Cheers.
Bye. Everyone.